On Monday, August 5th, Hurricane Debbie made landfall near Steinhatchee, Florida, as a Cat 1 hurricane with 80-mile-an-hour winds. After making landfall along Florida's Big Bend region, the storm slowed down considerably, eventually drifting to the east-northeast at only 3 miles an hour as it moved out into the Atlantic Ocean near the Georgia-South Carolina border. Debbie drifted generally east, then made a turn toward the north, eventually making a second landfall in South Carolina. But the slow motion of the storm prolonged days of rainfall, especially in the Carolinas. Debbie fits the pattern of many tropical cyclones that we've seen in the past decade, which have moved very slowly or even stalled near or after the time of landfall. On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, we will look into the science behind such stalling storms, their impacts on society, and what we can do to prepare for them. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, where we tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. GeoTrek explores the physical processes behind these extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of them to reduce the impacts on life and property. A quick bird's eye view of this topic, the United States has observed numerous hurricanes and tropical storms that have stalled out near or after landfall in recent years. From my perspective, the beginning of this modern era of stalled out storms started in 2012 as Hurricane Isaac stalled out just southwest of New Orleans along the Louisiana coast. This spread days of rainfall and storm surge into western Lake Pontchartrain communities like LaPlace, giving them worse impacts from Hurricane Isaac than they had in Katrina, which made landfall on the same date 7 years earlier. In 2015, a hurricane named Joaquin stalled out close to the Bahamas and sent a plume of rainfall for days into South Carolina. This generated catastrophic flood impacts near the state capital of Columbia. The next year, a hybrid storm without a name in 2016, but with some tropical characteristics, according to Louisiana State climatologist Barry Keim, stalled in South Louisiana, dumping more than 30 inches of rain. A home I had lived in just 6 months before this event, and well outside the 100-year floodplain, took on 18 inches of water. 2017 saw the impact of the wettest tropical cyclone in U.S. history as Hurricane Harvey stalled along the Texas coast for days, sending waves of massive rainfall into the Houston-Galveston corridor, as well as the Beaumont-Port Arthur area. Much of the metro Houston area observed more than 40 inches of rain, and Nederland, Texas, near Port Arthur, set the U.S. rainfall record for one storm with 61 inches of rain. During the following year, Hurricane Florence stalled out in 2017 near the North Carolina-South Carolina border after making landfall, dumping more than 30 inches of rain in the southern part of the Tar Heel State. If your head is starting to spin from all these stalled out storms, hang on, because this is a time where we're really starting to see one or two of these per year. 2019 brought two notable stalled out storms. The first was Hurricane Dorian, which stalled out as a Cat 5 hurricane over the Bahamas, inflicting some of the worst conditions imaginable from a hurricane. The U.S. coastline escaped with relatively minor damage, considering such a small margin of error on South Florida communities. Later in the season, Tropical Storm Imelda stalled out over southeast Texas, dumping more than 40 inches of rain in some areas impacted by Harvey just 2 years earlier. One site near Beaumont, Texas, observed 25 inches of rain in just 12 hours. 2020 brought us the pandemic and also Hurricane Sally, which had a forward speed of only 2 miles an hour as it made landfall along the Alabama coastline. The slow speed enabled Sally to lash South Alabama and the western Florida panhandle with extended rain and wind impacts that surprised many residents. This list I created documents six named storms and one unnamed storm that inflicted catastrophic flood damage and extended wind impacts to locations from Texas through North Carolina from slow-moving or stalled-out storms. Hurricane Debbie, downgraded to Tropical Storm Debbie by the time it was drifting off the Atlantic coast, became named storm number 7 on this list. To help us understand more about the science behind such slow-moving tropical cyclones, Jim Cawson, retired professor emeritus from University of Wisconsin and scientific advisor for the First Street Foundation, joins us on the podcast. After interviewing Jim, come join me on Tropical Storm Debbie fieldwork as we interview residents in the Carolinas to see how Debbie impacted them with a look back to previous stalled-out storms. Jim, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to to be doing this.
Jim, as we're recording this, I'm in a hotel room in southeastern North Carolina, and we're just getting pummeled by Tropical Storm Debbie rains, and it looks like we're in for it for several days. This storm just stalled out. And as I've been covering this storm, I thought, you know, who's done research on these tropical storms and hurricanes stalling out as they move on shore? And I found you've done a bunch of innovative research on this topic of stalled out tropical cyclones. What did you find in your research?
Yeah, well, we found actually a pretty good global signal of a general slowing down of this, what we're calling forward translational speed, which is how quickly a storm moves from one place to another, seems to be fairly robust throughout other ocean basins, but also in the Atlantic. And perhaps most pertinent to us here in our discussion, over the continental United States, there's been a significant slowing down, particularly of the slowest moving storms.
Jim, is this a signal you're seeing at landfall, out over the open water, or is it just kind of everywhere?
Seems to be mostly everywhere, although it also seems to be more a signal that's outside of the tropics, so away from the trade winds. We have at least a pretty strong hypothesis for why that would be true. And it all sort of resides in a nice, simple model of the idea that the way that the Earth is warming is not uniform. The higher latitudes are warming more quickly than the lower latitudes, right? It's called Arctic amplification. And since the winds, or any winds that a hurricane is in, would be called steering winds or steering flow, the winds are a direct function of the difference of temperature between the poles and the lower latitudes. And so if you reduce that difference, you reduce the winds. And if you reduce the winds, you reduce the speed that the storms are carried along in. So it's a nice, simple argument that's you know, not too difficult to argue for.
Sure. No, that's really interesting. And it sounds like you're saying, as you're reducing that difference in temperature and energy, you're essentially slowing down the steering currents that guide these hurricanes and tropical storms.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's more complexity to it that we're a little bit less sure about how it would work. And that's these ideas of these sort of jet stream or Rossby wave patterns. I'm not sure how technical this podcast gets, but the waviness of the jet stream has been argued to become more wavy under warming, and this leads to more cases of blocking where things stagnate, they don't move very much. So the whole system, the whole circulatory system, particularly of the middle latitudes, which the United States is entirely in, tends to be weakening.
Jim, what if someone said, okay, so big deal, this doesn't mean that I'm going to see a higher category hurricane hit me. Why should it matter if it slows down? What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, that's an easy one to respond to. And actually, the National Hurricane Center put out a really interesting article just last year where they revisited the death rate from water versus wind. And we've always known that water is the main cause of damage and mortality. And water would be a combination of saltwater flooding, which we call storm surge, and freshwater flooding, which is from rainfall. And the storm surge, of course, is generally not going to move too far away from the coast. So that's pretty much locked in. But the inland flooding, which you're experiencing now, can go all the way up to Michigan and into Canada, right? You can get these tremendous rains. So in terms of the risk that a hurricane poses to people on land, rainfall is huge. It's the biggest contributor. And this report that just came out last year showed that the proportion of deaths due to freshwater flooding have more than doubled since not too long ago. So, you know, they kind of split up their record. So the short answer to your question is, you know, we put way too much stock on how strong winds are. In terms of risk, it's not really the winds. From someone who has stood in Category 5 winds, you recognize the power that those have. But certainly overall, the risk and the danger comes from water. And most of that actually nowadays, because of good warnings and good forecasts, is coming from freshwater flooding. People don't evacuate for freshwater flooding. They evacuate for storm surge. So people are not going to be leaving places where the storm is tracking towards them if they're inland, you know, say Asheville, North Carolina. People are not going to say, we better get out of here. And so the flooding that happens is more likely to cause damage and take lives.
Jim, what you're talking about with these impacts moving inland, I mean, we've seen this in so many of these storms over the past decade, right? Hurricane Harvey, I know a lot of people where I lived in Galveston evacuated to Houston and lost their vehicles, almost lost their lives. And then it just, there were so many. Hurricane Florence, the year after, you know, in North Carolina, South Carolina, just stalling for days, places like Lumberton and Fayetteville, these places 30, 40 miles inland that might have thought they're out of reach of the water. All of a sudden, they're getting 30 plus inches of rain. So these impacts suddenly spreading out to millions of more people than if it was just at the coast, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, so you had, right, Harvey, Florence, and Dorian all one year after the other. Dorian, of course, was able to maintain its wind intensity at the same time because a lot of it was still over water because it was just sitting over the Bahamas. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, the actual wind damage of Hurricane Harvey while it was sitting there in the Houston area, or the wind damage from Florence as it was sitting there, was not that great, right? Because they're spinning down fairly quickly. They become a tropical storm. They're not doing a lot of wind damage, but they're dropping so much rain. So yeah, no question. I mean, that there's no place safe inland if you have a tropical storm, which is dumping almost as much rain as a major hurricane would in terms of, you know, inches per hour coming out of it. I use the analogy of taking a garden hose and putting a shower head on it. How much you turn the valve open gives you your rain rate. How fast you walk with it gives you the amount of rain that falls on the ground. If you stand there with it, you're going to get a big puddle in a hurry. So in terms of, you know, people will say that global warming is increasing rain rate because the atmosphere, warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, and hurricanes are really good at turning water vapor into rain. But in a slow moving storm, that translation speed far overwhelms any changes in the rain rate. It really is such a strong function of speed at that point.
And Jim, with the hose analogy, like you said, even if it's a very slow rate, if you're just going to stand there for 10 minutes, the rate in a sense is inconsequential, right? You're not moving. So you're going to get a lot of inundation just because you're not moving to another location, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's the elephant in the room, really. And the rain rate is a player, to be sure, but a smaller player.
Jim, what are the action items? So people that live in hurricane prone places listening to this message, realizing, okay, there are some changes, that there may be more rain at the coast and inland moving forward. What are some action items? How can people take this information and better prepare?
Well, yeah, the adaptation is a complex thing that involves, you know, a lot of social scientists and city planners and things like that. But I mean, it kind of boils down to a lot of things are designed around, say, a 100-year flood. And so if the 100-year flood is starting to turn into a 70-year flood or a 50-year flood, then the infrastructure and the adaptation measures and the planning measures as well all have to sort of take this new normal into account. I mean, tropical cyclones, fortunately, are fairly rare, right, compared to just flooding events in general. But yeah, I mean, certainly there's regions, say inland North Carolina, South Carolina, that are going to be much more susceptible to this sort of thing.
Well, and you know, we've seen these inland floods hit places like Nashville and Pennsylvania and all these places, but it seems like a lot of these are moving, especially say 50 to 100 miles inland. We seem to have seen a lot of these that, you know, they're not going to North Dakota. It's these places that are, they're within proximity of the Gulf Coast, within proximity of the southeastern Atlantic coast, but also they're not right on the coast. Maybe places that are, I don't know, an hour or two drive inland. It sounds like these areas really need to be aware and consider that potentially they'll see flooding in places they haven't.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing to consider too is that regions with topography that get this kind of rain can have compound effects of landslides. And a landslide can wipe out a community almost instantaneously with very little warning. So that also contributes to these mortality rates. And again, the one of the issues with this is that there's no real evacuation idea behind these, the way there is for a landfalling storm and a storm surge. So people are generally sheltering in place. I would be very curious to know what the statistics are for how many people actually drive out and evacuate when there's a storm coming and they're predicting heavy rainfall. It's probably pretty small.
Jim, I'd imagine that's so much less because it's such a broad area is under the gun, and it's really hard to pinpoint exactly where the heaviest rain bands will set up, right? So if you evacuate 30 miles to one direction or the other, you don't necessarily reduce your risk, right? Compared to storm surge, which is really based on your elevation and proximity to the coast, right?
That's an excellent point. Yeah, yeah. So which again, further complicates things, you know, where do I evacuate to? Yeah, so it certainly is an issue, and if this slowing down and stalling is truly part of a longer term trend that's going to keep on going in this direction, then this is something that needs to be taken very seriously. And I've been arguing now for a while that we focus a little bit too much on frequency and intensity, and we don't focus enough on track changes. Because you can have all the changes in frequency and intensity in the world, but if the track changes in such a way that they're moving away from you or moving toward you, or if they're slowing down more, then the impacts are really tremendous.
I see what you're saying. So beyond just how many storms there are, it's also where are they going, right?
Absolutely. It's a huge thing. And that's been something a lot of my work is concentrated on, in addition to the slowing down of the translation speed. We've also found like poleward migration of these tracks to where they're increasing risk in places that at higher latitudes that aren't necessarily that used to seeing these storms. So again, has a tremendous effect on the risk landscape. And that's really what this all boils down to, right? So if you have a whole lot of really strong storms, but they all stay out to sea, then risk is actually quite low.
Yeah, Jim, what you're getting at here is really helping people, I think, understand their risk and potential impacts where they live. Like you said, based on the track or based on if a hurricane or tropical storm hits near you, it may stall out. You may see rain well inland in places that you hadn't before. Jim, really appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast. Hopefully, hopefully we won't see too many storms like Debbie this year. But if we do, I think the research you've done is really going to help people look into this and consider their risk a little bit differently and hopefully more realistically.
I hope that's true. And thanks again for having me. It's really been enjoyable chatting with you.
Thanks, Jim, for providing such insightful perspectives on the topic of slow-moving tropical cyclones. Jim provided some strong reasoning about why tropical cyclones may be moving slower, mentioning Arctic amplification, whereby the Arctic is warming faster than the tropics, as well as the concept of the jet stream becoming more wavy, which slows down atmospheric circulation. I appreciated that he provided insights about the impacts of such slow storms at the coast and inland by reminding us that fatalities from heavy rainfall and hurricanes and tropical storms are increasing, as these are not really hazards that people evacuate from. If you want to learn more about the research that Jim has done on this topic, check out the peer-reviewed paper he published in the prestigious journal called Nature in 2018, titled A Global Slowdown of Tropical Cyclone Translation Speed. With these perspectives that Jim shared in mind, come join me now as I spent time on the ground in the Carolinas in the days preceding, during, and following Tropical Storm Debbie's rainfall. I started off my field interviews in Columbia, South Carolina, site of the catastrophic 2015 flooding. A woman named Karen Fitch shared insights about what she experienced during that storm. I'm here in Columbia, South Carolina with Karen. Karen, I mean, we're seeing the storm stall out. Do you think a lot of people here locally think back to 2015 and what happened back then with a storm like this?
I think some people do, especially now that they're forecasting that potentially there could be more rain than in 2015. But at the same time, it seems sometimes people around here don't take it as seriously because every year when a hurricane does come in, they always forecast something major catastrophic happening and then nothing does. And so it's kind of a 50-50.
So over time people might think there's a lot of false alarms, like they always hype this up and nothing happens.
Yes, they make a lot of closures, especially school closures, and you know, especially with hurricane paths, it constantly changes. One day it's telling us it's coming to us, and then an hour, 2 hours later, it's going the opposite direction. So, but 2015 definitely, I mean, we didn't even expect it to be that bad, and it was really sad what happened.
Karen, could you tell us a little bit about what happened in 2015? We know there was just epic, I mean, extraordinary amount of rain. I mean, I'd imagine it took a lot of people off guard. I mean, what were your memories of that storm?
I was teaching school at the time, and I remember that we got, they told us we had a few days off, and a few days turned into a whole week. During that week, I lived close to the river, and we watched the river rise, and then ended up, as the week progressed, dams were taken out, roads were closed and washed away. A really sad memory I have is that they had just opened up a new PetSmart, and it flooded so badly that it killed all the animals inside, and that really, like, it was really sad.
Yeah, the loss of life is just incomprehensible, and it's like, wow, you can't get that back. And especially when we see whole cities flooded, it's one thing on the coast or just to see rivers rising, but when cities get inundated and there's loss of life, that's you can't get that back, right?
Yes, and I also remember another story of a man who was, I think he was around 90 years old. He was traveling from Canada down to Florida for his, like, I guess he lived down there half the year, and he and his dog were traveling and they got stuck in Colombia, and they were, he and his dog were stuck on top of the car and just waiting for rescue. I think he was up there for 4 or 5 hours, and finally they got him safe. But it was just really, it was sad, but it was also like uplifting that they were able to like save him, because it could have been so much worse.
You were telling me the river was rising, you had bridge failures, dam failures. I mean, all over the place, things were going wrong back then, right?
Yes, it was. I mean, it happened so fast because it just seemed just like normal rain. We didn't realize how badly it was collecting. And also, I think it was kind of an eye-opening to the city of how many areas we had that were just such pitfalls. And, you know, like I think back-to-back when New Orleans happened, they didn't expect what happened there because they didn't realize that the infrastructure they had set was doomed to break, and that's kind of what happened to us.
Karen, thanks for sharing your insights. I hope for Tropical Storm Debbie, I hope it moves through faster than forecast, and obviously that you don't have those kind of impacts around here this time.
Yes, for sure. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
After interviewing Karen, I drove into North Carolina, where I expected the heaviest rainfall and greatest impacts from Tropical Storm Debbie to occur. After the heaviest rainfall had passed, I drove over to Lumberton on the Lumber River to learn about potential flood impacts. I had first visited Lumberton in 2018 as the river engulfed much of the southern part of town following the extraordinary rainfall from Hurricane Florence. This time, the river was well within the banks, at least when I was there, as I struck up a conversation with weather enthusiasts Chris and Amanda Osborne. They explain how Tropical Storm Debbie ingesting a lot of dry air helped reduce rainfall and reduce the flood impacts on the ground. Here right now in Lumberton, North Carolina, with Chris and Amanda. Y'all are very weather aware. You said you were watching the storm throughout it, and it sounds like you both said dry air really helped you out this time, right?
Yeah, the dry air really did help Lumberton out a little bit. Just the river standpoint, I mean, it's still going to be rising over the next couple of days. But, I mean, the dryer did help us out a whole lot.
Amanda, as you saw the storm forecast to stall out, were you thinking back to Hurricane Florence in 2018? What were your thoughts when you were looking at the forecast for Tropical Storm Debbie?
I was definitely hoping that it was not going to be what we had before. And like Chris said, the dry air helped us out as far as the rainfall over the past 2 days. So the river's still going to rise, so we could still be dealing with a lot of flooding.
Yeah, for sure. So do a lot of your friends, you know, follow the weather as closely as y'all do? I know you've had a lot of hurricane impacts over the last 10 years. Do y'all stand out as far as people interested in weather? Were you always weather enthusiast, or is it just the nature of living here with all the floods y'all have had in recent times?
Well, I've always thought about I wanted to go out west and be a storm chaser around, see the tornadoes and everything. And then living here, you more or less can get down to the coast, you can actually get see some of the hurricanes come in. We was actually wanting to go and see some of this storm come in, but we never did get the chance to go. And I've always, like I said, I've always wanted to be a storm chaser. That's something I love to do.
Seems like a passion of yours is to follow the weather and to see the impacts of it, huh?
Yes, it is. I mean, just some of the stuff that I've seen here since I've, you know, lived here and everything. And it's just something that I would just love to do.
Could you take me back to Hurricane Florence 2018? I mean, that was such an exceptional flood here. That was my first time in Lumberton. What was that like? Were people expecting that it could be like that? Was it way outside the realm of what people thought could happen? I mean, what was that like in your experience?
It was way outside of the realm. We had never really had anything like that occur in Lumberton. People panicked. There was, you know, a rush of buying up everything they could buy to store up. And then when this one, when we heard it could possibly be as bad, it was a flashback. You know, the stores were crowded, the gas stations were lined up. So people were really getting prepared for the worst.
It sounds like they were thinking back to Florence and taking it really seriously, like this could be another Florence.
Yes, definitely. And I'm glad it wasn't.
With Florence in 2018, was that more riverine flooding or from the rainfall locally or a combination of both?
A combination of both. Yeah.
Yeah, I was amazed. I was on the South Carolina-North Carolina border for that and just coming over to Lumberton, and it was days after the rainfall stopped, the river was still coming up. It seemed like sometimes those riverine floods, it's hard to grasp. Like the storm may make landfall on a Monday, your rain may end on Wednesday, and your rivers may not peak until the following week, right?
Yeah. Exactly. I know personally we were without power for at least 10 days and the county shut our water off, so we didn't have any running water for about a week.
Yeah. So, yeah. Any other insights on local storms, local weather history here? Chris, I know you're a weather buff. I mean, what other things have you seen in this part of the world?
I mean, I've actually seen a tornado around. It was when I was a kid and everything in school, and it impacted more Red Springs. And a teacher told me that a pine needle had drilled through a piece of wood column.
So the wind was moving that fast to move a pine needle through wood.
Yes, it was. And then over and over from the south side of town, it'll flood up real bad. And if in cases like this, we have heavy rains. And I used to work, matter of fact, when Florence come through, I think, I used to work over by the old Pepsi plant and UPS, and you couldn't get back there for, like, days.
Well, the floodwater was just that high for that long.
Yeah, it was. And there, you can actually see people come in with the Black Hawk helicopters, the military and everything, having to airlift people out that was on top of their roofs and stuff.
So that just the riverine part of that was probably at least 10 to 14 days, right?
Yes. It was.
What, and for y'all, I mean, were you impacted that long, or was the bigger impact for you in Florence the power outage?
Mostly the power outage and the water. Where we stay on our side of town, luckily we didn't have much flooding. Most of the south side of town and the west side of town is where a lot of the flooding occurs near the river.
Chris and Amanda, appreciate you all coming on the podcast. Best wishes and hopefully for a quick recovery here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I kept in touch with Chris after I left Lumberton, and he did an amazing job of providing me with pictures, water levels, and local observations. Unfortunately, he shared that there was one drowning death due to a car getting swept away in 8 inches of rushing water near the Columbus and Robeson County line. Remember that most flood fatalities occur in vehicles, and even a shallow amount of fast-flowing floodwater can sweep a car away. From Lumberton, I drove north on I-95, eventually coming to a town called Wilson, east of Raleigh, that was experiencing some quick flood impacts from Tropical Storm Debbie's bands of heavy rain that were still moving inland. A local resident named David and a city worker who is barricading flooded roads took time to share their perspectives with me. Such advanced traffic warnings keep motorists out of harm's way, and I was impressed to see so many drivers in this area heeding the warnings to find alternate routes. A field observation I wanted to share, I was observing flooding on a creek that ran through Wilson called Hominy Swamp. I was really amazed by how quickly the floodwaters rose and then receded in this area. At 4:15 p.m., I observed fast-flowing floodwater over roads that was deep enough and swift enough to sweep away vehicles. By 6:30 p.m., just a little more than 2 hours later, all of the water was completely gone from the roads. This type of fast-moving flood is more prevalent in micro-watersheds within urban and suburban areas and can be contrasted to long-duration floods that occur on bigger rivers or often along coastlines during storm surge events. I saw the City of Wilson workers doing an excellent job of quickly responding to the flood threat and staying ahead of its impacts.
Hey, my name's Hal.
Dave.
David, nice to meet you. So how was the flood? I mean, did it affect y'all in your neighborhood or anything?
Yeah, it affected a lot of people in our neighborhood. So it's just a bad, I mean, it's always something in Wilson.
Yeah, I saw it just kept raining and raining and the storm didn't move, you know?
The storm is not over. It's still coming.
Yeah. Y'all did such a good job putting out the signage and stuff. Why is that so important?
Advanced traffic warning is always important to let the driver know what's coming ahead of them. We try to do that to prevent any accidents or people stalling out. And when it gets dark and it's late night, you know, anything can happen. So we try to prevent that and make it safe as possible.
I will say I saw a lot of people turning around at the access points that were blocked off, not trying to go through. I was impressed by that. A lot of people did not try to go across the rushing water.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I would like to think, you know, that the advance warning helped. So that shows us that we're doing some things correctly, and you know, we try to continue to do so in the future.
Thank you so much. Keep up the great work.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
As I wrapped up my time in the Carolinas, I heard an amazing success story from the city of Raleigh, where proactive measures were taken to lower the level of Lake Johnson before the arrival of Tropical Storm Debbie's rains. This reduced flood impacts downstream after the storm. A city staff told me the lake rises 1 foot for every inch of rainfall in the area. Raleigh also deployed a stormwater team to clean out drains to improve runoff and drainage in the storm. Such proactive measures fit the perspective that we cannot stop storms from coming, but there are things we can do to get out ahead of them to reduce their impacts. I want to mention also Raleigh fits this description of a city that's, you know, close enough to the Atlantic or Gulf to get this extended moisture from a stalled out tropical storm or hurricane, but not right on the coast either. And we think about Raleigh, we think about Columbia, South Carolina, Atlanta, Baton Rouge. A lot of these places are not prone to storm surge, but they can get this inland flooding, as Jim Cosson was mentioning. Hopefully we don't have another slow-moving hurricane or tropical storm impact like Debbie again this year, but if we do, the lessons I learned from watching residents and communities respond to this storm in the Carolinas, as well as scientific perspectives from Jim Cosson, will help us to prepare to reduce impacts wherever we live. Until we meet again, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.